All right, we're in 1 Kings chapter 8 tonight. As you recall from our study, it was not last week. I was in California last week. But the week before, when we covered chapter 6 and 7, Solomon had spent 7 years building the temple. Now it's complete in its construction, and it's time to turn the structure basically into the house of God, transforming it from a building to a dwelling place or a meeting place with God. And so in chapter 8, verse 1, it says, "Then Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the leaders of the fathers' households of the sons of Israel, to King Solomon, Jerusalem, to bring up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord from the city of David, which is in Zion." Now, Solomon is having the Ark brought up from Zion, and you might say, Zion, you know, Pastor Ron, I never hear you talk about Zion. And that's because as we go through the Bible, we haven't come to Zion all that much. As a matter of fact, this is only the second time this word has been used in the Bible. It will become a more frequent term as we go through, especially in the Psalms and the Prophets. It'll become a more frequently used term. But basically, remember that Jerusalem was not always the same size that it is today. During the days of David, it was actually even much smaller than it was now in the time of Solomon. And so the city of David is actually... You know, when you think of the city of David, you would think of probably Jerusalem. But it's actually not the whole city of Jerusalem. It's just the southeast corner of Jerusalem, which is kind of down the hill from Temple Mount, Mount Zion, where Solomon has had the temple built. Now, as you look at Jerusalem, either a map in your study Bible of Solomon's days, or even if you look at a map today, Temple Mount is included in the city of Jerusalem. It's pretty much the whole eastern half. Well, just south of that, just down Mount Zion a little bit, was the original city of Jerusalem, called the City of David or Zion. And so that's why you hear Jerusalem referred to as Zion, or the City of David referred to as Zion, sometimes called the Old City. If you take a trip to Israel, they'll talk about the Old City. What that means is literally it's the Old City. It's the city that was there originally before it expanded out. Kind of like if you lived in Cheyenne 10 years ago or 15 years ago, typically you'll drive people around and you'll take them up on Del Range and say, "Oh yeah, none of this was here," you know, and you point to the mall and this wasn't here 15 years ago and Buffalo Ridge and all that stuff. Oh, this was all dirt roads and things. It expands, you know. So if we were talking about Cheyenne 100 years ago, certainly we wouldn't be including Del Range and Riding Club and Powder House and all those streets up there. We would be talking about the Old City. And so that is technically what Zion is. It's the Old City or the City of David, the smaller part of Jerusalem there. And so King Solomon sent downhill for the Ark of the Covenant. Remember, it was set up in that tent of meeting there, and they brought it up. Verse 2, "All the men of Israel assembled themselves to King Solomon at the feast in the month Ethanim, which is the seventh month." Now, there are Ethanim is the seventh month, actually the seventh month of the Jewish calendar, not the seventh month of our calendar. I mean, when we think of the seventh month, we're thinking July. Actually, Ethanim is around the October-November crossover on our calendar. And verse 2 says that there was a feast there in the seventh month. If you read through your Old Testament, if you go to the book of Leviticus chapter 23, you'll see God commanding the various feasts, the seven feasts that he gave to Moses. And in the seventh month there, on the 15th day of the month, is what we call the Feast of Tabernacles, sometimes called the Feast of Booths or the Feast of the Ingathering. That was on the 15th day of the seventh month, and it was a week-long, not only a feast, but kind of a camp-out, because the Israelites would actually construct booths made out of palm branches and other foliage. I've never been able to pronounce that word. Is that right? Foliage? Okay. I used to think it was foliage. So now, yeah. So they construct these booths, and the reason that God said to do this every year was to remind the Jews that he said, "When I called you guys out of Egypt, I had you live in tabernacles or tents or booths." And indeed, God tabernacled among them as well. Not only were the Israelites living in tents, But God himself was there meeting with them in a tent in the center of that group in the tabernacle. God would tabernacle among the people. And so the Feast of Tabernacles was a time when they would be reminded of that journey out of Egypt, how they were living in booths. It also points prophetically, and we're not going to get into this tonight, if you want to pick up the tapes on Leviticus 23, this covers in more detail. But prophetically, it points to the time when God will again tabernacle with his people during the millennial kingdom, when Christ, after Christ's second return to earth, and he sets up again his kingdom on Mount Zion. He's going to tabernacle among the people when we can say, hey, you know, let's go take a trip and talk to the Lord, you know, visit the Lord in the tabernacle. Wouldn't that be cool? You know, maybe tonight you're saying, you know, well, hey, let's head on to church. You know, nothing. It's only reruns on TV now. You know, we're getting into the summer. And so let's go on up and meet with the Lord in church. Well, you know, it's, yeah, God meets us here, but we're talking about going and meeting up with the Lord face to face. You know, hey, Lord, I was doing a Bible study and I had a question about this. And, you know, wouldn't that be great? You wouldn't need the Bible Answer Man program anymore, or to every man an answer. You just, hey, let's go up to Jerusalem, Mount Zion, and ask the Lord what he meant exactly by that. So the Feast of Tabernacles, the seventh month, that was, if you notice, he actually waited from the finish of the temple to the time that they're doing this is about 11 months. I mean, he waited quite a while. He waited for this feast to come around before he actually did this. And my thinking, there's some commentators have some various ideas about it. My thinking is, what better holiday to celebrate the Lord's house than the Feast of Tabernacles? When it speaks of God tabernacling among his people, what better day to celebrate this feast, or what better day to initiate the temple, or to usher the Ark of God into the temple than the Feast of Tabernacles? So all the elders of Israel came, and the priests took up the Ark, and they brought up the Ark of the Lord and the tent of meeting and all the holy utensils which were in the tent, and the priests and the Levites brought them up. And King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel who were assembled to him were with him before the ark, sacrificing so many sheep and oxen, they could not be counted or numbered. That's quite a few sacrifices, especially when we get to the end of this chapter and see that there were afterwards, once it's all done, you know, they sacrificed 22,000 oxen, 120,000 sheep. Well, that's a number they kept track of. But now they're sacrificing so many that they cannot keep track of here. And notice too that it says the priests took up the ark, that Solomon was not going to make the same mistake that his father David had done. When his father David moved the ark, you remember that he said, oh, well, let's bring the ark up to Jerusalem, let's bring it up to Zion. When they had it brought up, he said, well, let's make a new cart, you know, like the way the Philistines had done it, you know, let's identify with the world here. And they built a new cart and they put the Ark of the Covenant up there. And they were just cruising along really happy until the cart that was in kind of hit a rut, and it looked like the Ark was going to fall over. And so a guy reached his hand up to steady it, and poof, he was dead. And they were kind of worried about that. And so Solomon wasn't going to make that same mistake. He was going to bring it in the way that the Lord had told it to be carried. pardon me. They offered all these sacrifices. Then the priests, verse 6, brought the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord to its place, into the inner sanctuary of the house, to the most holy place, under the wings of the cherubim. For the cherubim spread their wings over the place of the Ark, and the cherubim made a covering over the Ark and its poles from above. Remember that the Ark had cherubim on it, two solid gold cherubim extending their wings outward and upward over the mercy seat, the solid gold lid of the of this box. But Solomon had also constructed two massive cherubim of the same shape and the same look, only these were made out of olive wood, and they were 15 feet high. Their wingspans were so massively wide, and these were covered in gold, by the way, so they looked like they were solid gold. Their wings reached across and touched one edge of the room, the most holy place, or the holy of holies. The other wing extended out to touch the wing of the next one, and so between their two wingspans, they covered the entire room. And so as they placed the Ark of the Covenant in there, they placed it under the wings that were touching on the inside. And it says that the cherubim made a covering over the Ark and its poles from above. But the poles were so long that the ends of the poles could be seen from the holy place before the inner sanctuary, but they could not be seen outside. They're there to this day. Now remember, because the Ark was not supposed to be carried on a cart, it had to be carried some way, wasn't supposed to be touched. And so the Lord, when he commissioned Moses to create these things, these holy pieces of furniture, basically, in the tabernacle, he had him construct golden rings that were on the bottom four corners of these pieces of furniture, and these poles were slid into the rings, and therefore they could carry the Ark of the Covenant and the table of showbread and the altar of incense, etc. They could carry it with these poles and not touch the holy pieces of furniture here. But as these poles this is put in place, the poles are so long that they're actually sticking out from the Holy of Holies, or the most holy place, to where you could see them from the holy place. That's the larger first room that the priests would walk into. They didn't even go into the back room. The only time they ever went into that Holy of Holies, the only one that ever went in was the high priest, and the only time he ever did that was on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And that was after, you know, incredible ceremonial washings and sanctifications, otherwise he would be stricken dead. You know, the Lord said in Leviticus 16:2 that he shall not enter at any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat, which is on the ark, lest he die, for I will appear in the cloud over the mercy seat. And also in Leviticus 16, he goes on to talk about how on the Day of Atonement he would go in. Anyone else that would go in would die, no matter what the day was. In Numbers chapter 4, when God is talking about how these things are going to be moved, the tribe of Levi had a clan, one of three divisions, called the Kohathites, the sons of Kohath. And they were the ones that carried the various objects from the tabernacle. And he warned them in Numbers chapter 4 that they shall not go in to see the holy objects even for a moment, lest they die. They couldn't even see them. If they saw them even for a moment, they would be stricken dead. So, you know, that's some, you know, job. What do you call that when a job is dangerous? You know, when OSHA comes in and closes you down? Okay. You're crazy. Yeah. Pardon me. So that was, it was a dangerous workplace. And so this at first would make me nervous when it talks about these poles sticking out from the most holy place, from the Holy of Holies. I would be afraid that if you saw those poles, that you'd be stricken down dead. And I was thinking about that and praying about that this week and saying, Lord, why weren't they stricken dead? You know, what exactly is the thing? And it turns out that the poles weren't part of the ark. The poles themselves were not holy. They weren't holy poles. Because in Numbers 4, when he was talking to the telling the Kohathites, he said, you know, they're supposed to lay coverings over the ark and the table and the altar, these things, and then insert the poles. And he said in Numbers 4:15, he says, when Aaron and his sons have finished covering the holy objects and all the furnishings of the sanctuary, when the camp is to set out, after that the sons of Kohath shall come to carry them so that they may not touch the holy and die. So God did not consider the poles holy. Only the Ark of the Covenant was holy, but the poles themselves were not. And so as the poles were sticking out, they wouldn't be stricken dead for seeing the holy poles, because they weren't holy poles. They were just with the holy Ark there. So holy poles. What a great... We gotta make a club like that or something. Okay, so we're at verse 9. There was nothing in the Ark except the two tablets of stone, which Moses put there at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the sons of Israel and when they came out of the land of Egypt. Now, this struck me as odd at first this week, because saying there was nothing in the ark except the two tablets, I thought for sure there was other stuff in there. It was like a treasure chest. It was like a moving box. where God had told them to put various things. And as I looked through that, and I looked back through the Old Testament, I seemed to recall that there was a jar of manna that they had put in there, and I seemed to recall that there was Aaron's rod, which had budded, that had been put in there. And so I went back to check those things out, and I was really surprised at what I found. This is not a commonly held belief. Again, it's nothing that's going to make you lose your salvation or anything, or hopefully me. But I take a different stand from a lot of commentators on this based on my studies this week. And so let me just share that with you. Number one, people believe that Aaron's rod was in there, that the jar of manna was in there, and the Ten Commandments were in there. But when I went back to read these things in Exodus 16, when it's talking about the manna, Moses said to Aaron, "Take a jar and put an omer full of manna in it and place it before the Lord, to be kept throughout your generations, as the Lord commanded Moses." So Aaron placed it before the testimony to be kept. It sounds to me as I'm reading this that it wasn't actually placed inside the Ark of the Covenant, but it was actually placed before it. The same case for Aaron's rod. You remember that some guys rose up against the authority of Moses and Aaron and challenged, you know, whether God had put them in charge or not, and God said, "Well, just take everybody's walking sticks, you know, their rods, and put them all here, and I'll make it really clear who I'm approving of." And so they wrote their names on all these things, and they came in the next day, and Aaron's rod, everybody else's rods were the same, but Aaron's rod had budded with these buds and blooms and ripe almonds. You know, if you can imagine, that'd be kind of cool. You have a walking stick or a cane that just pops out an almond joy every day or something, you know. It's an anointed walking stick. And so the Lord said to Moses, "Put back the rod of Aaron before the testimony," again, before the testimony, "to be kept as a sign against the rebels, that you may put an end to their grumblings against me, so that they should not die." Thus Moses did, just as the Lord had commanded him, so he did. Now, again, it sounds to me like these things were placed in the Holy of Holies, or what's called the Most Holy Place, that room that the Ark of the Covenant was in, but it doesn't sound like they popped the lid off this thing and put these things in there. The reason most people believe that those things were in there because of what Hebrews 9:4 says. And when you're reading Hebrews 9:4 in English, it seems pretty clear. It says, the ark contained the gold jar of manna, Aaron's staff that had budded, and the stone tablets of the covenant. That's what the NIV says. It says it's contained that. King James says, wherein was the golden pot that had manna and Aaron's rod that had budded and the tables of the covenant. And even the New American Standard renders it, in which was the gold jar holding the manna, Aaron's rod, which budded, and the tables of the covenant. So it sounds, when you're reading that, no matter what version you're reading that, you say, oh, well, they must have put it in there. And so that's why most people believe they put it in there. But as I was getting a little deeper into the Greek this week, I found that the Greek preposition that is rendered contained in the NIV, wherein in the King James, and in which in the New American Standard, is actually a pretty generic preposition that, depending on the way the translators read it into context, it can mean in, but it also can mean on or by or with. And so you'd be very justified in reading Hebrews 9:4 as saying that the golden jar of manna and Aaron's rod that budded were with the Ark of the Covenant, not in the Ark of the Covenant. So again, nothing to really get bent out of shape about. Speaking of bent out of shape, I was thinking that I had this pretty well solved even before I started tracking these things down, because I started thinking about the dimensions of the Ark of the Covenant, you know, how many cubits, what was it, 2.5 cubits and 1.5 cubits and 1.5 cubits, and worked that all out into inches. And I thought, well, what's the biggest stick that you could really put in that thing? And not having been altogether coherent in my geometry years, I didn't retain any of those things. So I called up somebody who's really good in geometry and said, "Hey, here's the dimensions of this box. What's the biggest stick I could put in there?" And it turned out to be 40 some odd or 50 let's see, about 53 inches. You could actually put a rod of 53 inches, which is actually big enough to be a rod, especially because, you know, people were shorter back then. You know, the average, well, seriously, the average Jewish person, from my understanding, even in Jesus' day 2,000 years ago, is about 5'3", 5'4". So their walking stick probably would be a little shorter than ours. But I thought I had this problem licked because I thought, you know, well, if you couldn't fit the, I mean, what would you do? It's like the Lord said, hey, take Aaron's rod and put it there in the Ark of the Covenant. It's like, okay, no problem, Lord. Bend it over your knee and snap it. All right. But no, you could actually probably fit it in there. So, you know, again, nothing to divide the church over, you know. But just to let you know, that's my take on it. And if you listen to the tapes back from Exodus or Numbers or whenever we talked about this, you'll hear me saying the opposite, that it was actually in there. So beware the double-minded man, I'll tell you. So in verse 10, it says that it came about. At this point, the only thing in there is the tablets of the testimony, the Ten Commandments there. That's the only thing that's in there. Now, if you think that those things were in there before, then you have to really come up with an idea of how they got out, you know. Because it's not like people just kind of went in there and popped it up, like it was on hinges, and said, oh, look, almonds, you know. And, oh, look, manna. Ooh, it's old now. You know, they didn't, you know, manna wasn't really all that edible if you waited a day anyway. But my personal take on it, again, is remember when the Philistines returned the Ark of the Covenant and it came riding in on the new cart that they had built it? And it came down, to Beth Shemesh. I'm pretty sure that's where it came to. And I remember that the guys of the city were like, oh, yeah, the Ark of the Covenant, it's back. And they popped the lid. They wanted to see what was inside of it. And they were all struck down. Like, again, that's off the top of my head, but I think it was about 50,000 guys were struck down for looking inside of that thing. And it must have been all at once, because you'd figure after the first couple guys, if they were going one by one, the first couple guys dropped dead. You know, you got to be really dumb for the next 49,000. Well, it probably won't affect me, you know. This is probably all at once. So anyway, you know, and if it was in a line, one after the other, they deserved it. I got to tell you. But anyway, so I don't think that anybody stole the jar of manna. I don't think that anybody stole the almond rod there. I think that they were not in there. Again, a personal take on the scripture there. But when it verse 10, it came about when the priest came from the holy place that the cloud filled the house of the Lord so that the priest could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. Then Solomon said, the Lord has said that he will dwell in the thick cloud. I have surely built thee a lofty house, a place for thy dwelling forever. So they get this thing put in there and suddenly things start smoking. You know, they didn't have smoke detectors back then. I don't know if they would have gone off or not, but the cloud is filling the place. And the priest couldn't even stand to minister because it wasn't a cloud. It wasn't like there was poor ventilation in this place. This was the glory of the Lord filling the house. And it was that same cloud. See, the glory of the Lord appears in a cloud because if we look at his glory, we get fried. I mean, like standing on the sun, you just get wiped out. And so he covers himself in the cloud, but the cloud, his glory is so intense that the cloud glows, and especially when it's night outside, the thing is just, have you ever walked outside during a summer thunderstorm? This happened to me about a month ago. Had some friends over, and as they were leaving, we walked outside, and off in the distance, there was this huge thunderhead. But you couldn't see the thunderhead because it was pitch black at night. But all you could see was the lightning erupting from inside of it. And so from all over the place, it looked like a show. And the only time you could really see the cloud was when it would be lit up and it looked like it was exploding from the inside. You know what I'm talking about if you've ever seen it. If you've never seen it, it's really too hard to describe. But if you could imagine the glory of the Lord in the cloud, like a constant lightning storm glowing from the inside, that is what it would have appeared to be, It's the same cloud that appeared to the Israelites in the wilderness, Exodus 16:10, if you're taking notes, that had covered Mount Sinai. Remember, Moses brought all the people to Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered the mountaintop there, the glory of God. Exodus 24:16. And also when they built the tabernacle, that the cloud covered and filled the tabernacle. Exodus 40 and Numbers 16 talk about those things. Numbers chapter 9 talks about the day that the tabernacle was erected and the cloud covered the tabernacle, the tent of the testimony. Pardon me. And in the evening, it was like the appearance of fire over the tabernacle. So this is far more intense than even a lightning storm and a thunderhead. It was like this until morning. So it was continually. The cloud would cover it by day, and it had the appearance of fire at night. And so that's my personal belief, is that this is the same thing that led the Israelites out of Egypt. Remember that when they were being led through the wilderness, it said that they were being led by a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. I don't think God was changing it from cloud to fire to cloud to fire. I think the glory of the Lord was actually leading them, and this was the way it appeared to them. Exodus 13 talks about the Lord going before them in a pillar of cloud by day to lead them on the way, and in a pillar of fire by night to give them light. And I just love it when things make a little poem like that. A pillar of cloud by day to lead them on the way, and a pillar of fire by night to give them light. So you songwriters, go to town with that one. So the cloud now descends upon this. And again, I've got a lot of commentaries, and a lot of commentaries have not spent very much time on these chapters 6, 7, and 8 because, you know, this temple was inferior to the tabernacle, that it was, even though it was a bigger production, it wasn't an accurate model and things. But the fact is, God honored Solomon's heart here, and he honored the people's heart. He did come to dwell in this temple. It wasn't the ideal, it wasn't the tabernacle, but he did inhabit this place. And so the priest couldn't stand to minister there. Then the king faced about in verse 14 and blessed all the assembly of Israel while all the assembly of Israel was standing. And he said, blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who spoke with his mouth to my father David and has fulfilled it with his hand, saying, since the day that I brought my people Israel from Egypt, I did not choose a city out of all the tribes of Israel in which to build a house that my name might be there. But I chose David to be over my people Israel. Now it was in the heart of my father David to build a house for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. But the Lord said to my father David, because it was in your heart to build a house for my name, you did well that it was in your heart. Nevertheless, you shall not build the house, but your son who shall be born to you, he shall build the house for my name. Now the Lord has fulfilled his word which he spoke. For I have risen in place of my father David and sit on the throne of Israel as the Lord promised, and have built the house for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. And there I have set a place for the ark in which is the covenant of the Lord, which he made with our fathers when he brought them from the land of Egypt. So King Solomon standing before the people who are also standing, and speaking blessing over the people. And as he speaks blessing over the people, he's just reminding and recounting all that had happened, that God had led his people out of Egypt and made David king. And I'm skipping a lot of details in between. You're saying, no kidding, we've been in this study for 3 years and we haven't even covered that much. David became king. He said, oh, I want to build a temple for the Lord. Remember, and David's friend, the prophet, said, go for it. Do all that's in your heart. And then that night, God convicted him and said, what'd you tell David that for? I didn't tell you to tell him that. You go tell him it's not okay with me. I'm really blessed. Thanks for the thought, David, but I'm not going to have you do it. You're a man of blood. You're a man of war. So instead, I'll have your son build it. And so indeed, his son it has built it now that Solomon is king. And it took 7 years, and so it's been, Solomon's been king. He was king for 4 years, then 7 years, and then add a year because they took about a year to do it. So it's been about 12 years now since Solomon's been king that finally the temple is up and running, as it were. And So verse 22, then Solomon stood before the altar of the Lord in the presence of all the assembly of Israel and spread out his hands toward heaven. And he said, O Lord, the God of Israel, there is no God like thee in heaven above or on earth beneath, who art keeping covenant and showing loving kindness to thy servants who walk before thee with all their heart, who has kept with thy servant, my father David, that which thou hast promised him. Indeed, thou hast spoken with thy mouth and hast fulfilled it with thy hand as it is this day. That is an incredible run-on sentence. It's okay to have a run-on sentence when you're praying, I guess. If you read the writings of the Apostle Paul, he's got a lot of those sentences, too, that you go for paragraphs without ever seeing a period, and they're just hard to read out loud. So when you're reading it, you don't notice it. But when you're reading it out loud and you're waiting to take a breath, that's when you notice. But be that as it may, Solomon is lifting his hands to the Lord and praying and just talking about the faithfulness of God and saying, Lord, you've been so good to us. There's no God. There's a lot of gods that are called gods, but there's no God like you. And so now, therefore, O Lord, verse 25, the God of Israel, keep with thy servant David, with thy servant David, my father, that which thou hast promised him, saying, you shall not lack a man to sit on the throne of Israel, if only your sons take heed to their way to walk before me as you have walked. Remember, that promise of the continual lineage of David sitting on the throne was a conditional promise based on the faithfulness of David's kids. If Solomon stays faithful to the Lord, then Solomon's son will sit on the throne. And if Solomon's son is faithful to the Lord, then his grandson will sit on the throne. It will be perpetual throughout the generations. Now, one promise of the throne of David that was not conditional was that the throne would be eternal. That was an unconditional promise. And indeed, there is a man, Jesus Christ, who sits on the throne of David today and will for all eternity sit on the throne of David. But unfortunately, David's descendants from Solomon's kids on until you get to Jesus aren't going to be all that faithful. But he says, now therefore, O God of Israel, let thy word, I pray thee, be confirmed, which thou hast spoken to thy servant, my father David. But will God indeed dwell on the earth? Behold, heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain thee. How much less this house which I have built. You know, I like this. It took Solomon 7 years to build this thing. Cost billions of dollars. All kinds of tens of thousands of laborers and all sorts of planning and production and everything that went on. And when it was all said and done, you could imagine Solomon feeling pretty justified and saying, hey, Lord, how about these digs I made you, huh? You know, what do you think? It's a pretty nice condo here. You know, he could have had some pride. And if you've ever been a part of a church that's had a major building project, you know, a church responds in one of two ways. They respond with humility and say, hey, you know, God, you've been faithful and you've allowed us to have this place and we're thankful for it. Or the building becomes God. You know, and you've probably been part of churches in the past where, excuse me, where the building is God, you know, where it's like, oh man, this carpet's expensive. Don't come in here with bare feet. Don't let the kids in here. You know, they're going to track mud on the carpet and, you know, and the building itself becomes an idol. But Solomon's temple was not an idol. Solomon's temple here, he says, God, the heavens. I mean, think of the heavens for a second, where the earth is a microbe compared to the expanse of the heavens, and says, God, even the heavens can't contain you. God is bigger than this room. God is bigger than the temple. God is bigger than the earth. God is bigger than the creation that he's made, which is beyond what we could even fathom. I got to share this one thing. Stayed up till about 12:30 this morning, reading the latest Left Behind book. Finished it in a day, you know, which is always my big mistake because then I've got to wait another 8 months for the next one to come out. I don't know why I don't. It's kind of like waiting for the perfect dinner and then wolfing it down. But be that as it may, I won't give away anything in the story, but I do want to share with you one insight that I really liked about this book. This old man is having a dream. you know, in the last days, the young men will have visions and the old men will dream dreams, right? Well, he gets caught up into the universe, even beyond the universe, and he comes to this giant nose, okay? It's not just a nose, but he describes it as being like helicoptered up to a face on Mount Rushmore, to where you actually, if you could picture Mount Rushmore, where you actually have to back up to even see what it is. It turns out to be an angel. An angel as big as, whose face is as big as Mount Rushmore, and that doesn't give away any of the story. Don't worry if you haven't read this book yet. But I really like that, because we kind of think of angels as being, 6'3", 6'4", you know, pretty buffed out. And, you know, so God's got to be at least, 6'5". And when we think about how, and again, I don't want to belittle what the Bible says. Obviously, angels have appeared in the form of men, and they look just like men. And so I don't want to belittle that, and I don't want to make doctrine out of this. But I just, to me, it affected me. Because if you can think of an angel as being the size of Mount Rushmore, then you can start to expand your vision of God's bigger than this room. God's bigger than this church. God's bigger than this city. God's big. The heavens can't contain God. And we can't even, in our finite minds, we can't even fathom the distance between here and the moon. We can write it on paper, but we just don't get it. You know, a friend of mine that goes to the church called me up Wednesday, I think it was, and said, "Hey, I'm putting up a flagpole. Can you help me out?" You know, so I said, sure, and we had the forklift going. And the flagpole really didn't look that long. It was maybe about as long as this stage. I'm not very good at estimating. I think it was 22 or 23 feet. And you look at it, it's just not that big. But somehow, when you tilt the flagpole up, it seems a lot higher than it was long. And you know, what didn't look like very much is now incredibly intimidating when you try and look to the top of the flagpole and you get that little vertigo thing happening or whatever. And so if you picture, you know, that's pretty tall, and then you try to fathom and say, oh, that's like 20 feet up there, and then you try and calculate how many miles the moon is, and you just don't get it. Your mind can't comprehend it. You can write it on paper, but you just can't comprehend it. And that's our little Earth with its little satellite. And then your mind can't expand to the solar system or to the galaxy, the universe, all of creation. The heavens, even the high heavens, can't contain God. And so I think it's funny when we try to put God in a box, because we can't even imagine how big that box really is. And so Solomon, in all humility, as he's had his hands lifted, the whole time I've been talking, he's had his hands lifted. And he says, heaven and the highest heaven can't contain thee. How much less this house which I have built? Yet have regard to the prayer of thy servant and to his supplication. God is that big. God is that tremendous, unfathomably huge. And yet he inclines his ear when one of us talks to him. What a God. What a God. He's an awesome God. Have regard to the prayer of thy servant and to his supplication, O Lord my God, to listen to the cry and to the prayer which thy servant prays before thee today, that thine eyes may be open toward this house night and day, toward the place of which thou hast said, my name shall be there. To listen to the prayer which thy servant shall pray toward this place. And listen to the supplication of thy servant and of thy people Israel. When they pray toward this place, hear thou in heaven, thy dwelling place, hear and forgive. If a man sins against his neighbor and is made to take an oath, and he comes and takes an oath before thine altar in this house, then hear thou in heaven and act and judge thy servants, condemning the wicked by bringing his way on his head, on his own head, and justifying the righteous by giving him according to his righteousness. When thy people Israel are defeated before an enemy because they have sinned against thee, if they turn to thee again and confess thy name and pray and make supplication to thee in this house, then hear thou in heaven and forgive the sin of thy people Israel and bring them back to their land which thou didst give to their fathers." He's actually prophesying as he's praying, because this is, in fact, what is going to happen. Guys, this weekend we're going to be studying the book of Nehemiah. And the whole reason for the book of Nehemiah being written is because this, in fact, happened. Because the people of Israel did sin against God. And God did allow their enemies to have victory over them. The Babylonians came in and captured them and dragged them off to what we call the Babylonian captivity. And for 70 years, they were not in the land of Israel. But it says, if they turn to thee again and confess thy name and pray and make supplication, hear thou in heaven. Isn't that what Daniel was doing? Isn't that what Ezra and Zerubbabel and Nehemiah, those guys, great giants of the faith, were doing? They were turning towards Jerusalem and praying and confessing the sin of the nation and confessing their own sin. And God was faithful to bring them back to the land which he had given to their fathers. He continues to pray, again, still with his arms lifted. I mean, this is one strong man, I think. "When the heavens are shut up and there is no rain because they have sinned against thee, and they pray toward this place and confess thy name and turn from their sin when thou dost afflict them, then hear thou in heaven and forgive the sin of thy servants and of thy people Israel. Indeed, teach them the good way in which they should walk. And send rain on thy land, which thou hast given thy people for an inheritance." If there's a famine in the land, if there is pestilence, if there is blight or mildew, locust or grasshopper, if their enemy besieges them in the land of their cities, whatever plague, whatever sickness there is, whenever prayer or supplication is made by any man or by all thy people Israel, each knowing the affliction of his own heart, and spreading his hands toward this house, then hear thou in heaven thy dwelling place, and forgive and act and render to each according to all his ways, whose heart thou knowest. For thou alone dost know the hearts of all the sons of men, that they may fear thee all the days that they live in the land which thou hast given to our fathers. He just prays and says, God, you know every heart. And render to each according to their heart. Receive the repentance and judge the wicked. Verse 41, "Also concerning the foreigner who is not of thy people Israel, when he comes from a far country for thy name's sake, for they will hear of thy great name and thy mighty hand and of thine outstretched arm. When that foreigner comes and prays toward this house, hear thou in heaven thy dwelling place and do according to all for which the foreigner calls to thee, in order that all the peoples of the earth may know thy name, to fear thee as do thy people Israel. And that they may know that this house which I have built is called by thy name." Interesting, Solomon's heart. If you look at the Jews by the time of Jesus, this was not their heart. A foreigner who had come, you know, a Gentile, a non-Jew who had come. Oh, well, we'll make allowance. We'll make accord to the Gentiles. But if they go past there, they will be killed. And archaeologists have even found on Temple Mount, reading this in Biblical Archaeology Review, number of years ago, that they actually have the text of the signs which were placed around the inner court saying, and again, this is not a quote, if you're a Gentile and you go past this point, you're going to be killed. You know, no trespassing. You know, you've heard of beware of dog. Well, this is let the dog beware. You know, they called the Gentiles dogs. So let the dog beware here. But Solomon's heart was that people from all over the world would come and worship the Lord here. "When thy people go out to battle against their enemy, by whatever way thou shalt send them, and they pray to the Lord toward the city which thou hast chosen, and the house which I have built for thy name, then hear in heaven their prayer and their supplication and maintain their cause. When they sin against thee, for there is no man who does not sin." Hey guys, if you're tired of, in your witnessing, quoting, you know, "There is none righteous, no, not one," here you go. 1 Kings 8:46. "There is no man who does not sin." Put a little diversity in your witnessing this week. "There is no man who does not sin." And the women are going, yes. And thou art angry with them and dost deliver them to an enemy so that they take away thy, take them away captive to the land of the enemy, far off or near. If they take thought in the land where they have been taken captive and repent and make supplication to thee in the land of those who have taken them captive, saying, we have sinned and committed iniquity. Again, returning to this prophesying of the captivity. We have sinned and have committed iniquity. We have acted wickedly. If they return to thee with all their heart and with all their soul in the land of their enemies who have taken them captive and pray to thee toward the land, toward their land, which thou hast given to thy, to their fathers, the city which thou hast chosen, and the house which I have built for thy name, then hear their prayer and their supplication in heaven, thy dwelling place, and maintain their cause, and forgive thy people who have sinned against thee, and all their transgressions which they have made, have they have transgressed against thee, and make them objects of compassion before those who have taken them captive, that they may have compassion on them. This is amazing, because his prophecy even getting more detailed, his prayer actually becoming the words of prophecy. And if I can find this real quick, just studying this week in preparation for the studies in Nehemiah, I think it's at the end of 2 Chronicles. Let's see. Yeah, at the very end of 2 Chronicles here, in 2 Chronicles 36:22. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, Jeremiah also prophesied this, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he sent a proclamation throughout his kingdom and put it in writing, saying, thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he's appointed me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever there is among you of all his people, may the Lord his God be with him, and let him go up. And so you see the mercy that God put in the leader's heart. This guy was not saved. He was the king of Babylon, of the Babylonian kingdom that had enslaved the Jews in captivity for 70 years. God stirred up his spirit. And Solomon's prayer was answered when, back now at this dedication prayer, Solomon is saying, you know, let those who have, let's see, where are we? Verse 50. Make them objects of compassion before those who have taken them captive, that they may have compassion on them. And so Solomon's prayer was answered. Do you know that a prayer you pray today can be answered even after you die? Isn't that amazing? You know, let's say you're praying for your brother-in-law. Your brother-in-law is not saved. And you've been praying for him every day. And, you know, they end up moving away and you lose the influence over him. You know, you say, man, Lord, you know, you really missed that opportunity to save my brother-in-law. And even after he moves away, he can get saved. Even after you die, he can get saved. Even when he's an old man and you're long since gone to be with the Lord, he can be saved. God can answer those prayers. Let's not only pray when we see answered prayer, but let's know that the God of heaven hears every one of our prayers. And oftentimes we're praying according to his will, but not according to his timetable. And so we need to remember that. This prayer was answered long after Solomon was gone. And let's see. Anybody remember what verse we left off on? 51. Hey, you guys are following along. That's great. For they are thy people and thine inheritance, which thou hast brought forth from Egypt from the midst of the iron furnace, that thine eyes may be open to the supplication of thy servant and to the supplication of thy people Israel, to listen to them whenever they call to thee. For thou hast separated them from all the peoples of the earth as thine inheritance, as thou didst speak through Moses thy servant, when thou didst bring our fathers forth from Egypt, O Lord God. That's the end of Solomon's prayer there. Now, I would not recommend this as a good prayer before dinner. You know, okay, family, everyone raise their hands as Solomon did. We're just going to recite this prayer that was half of a chapter long. The food gets cold and people aren't really in the spirit of prayer anymore. But it came about that when Solomon had finished praying this entire prayer and supplication to the Lord, he arose from before the altar of the Lord, from kneeling on his knees with his hands spread towards heaven. Man, he had his hands up that whole... I can't get over that. I'm telling you. If you lift up your hands... I didn't practice this week, but if you lift up your hands and you say that prayer out loud, your arms are going to hurt by the end of that prayer. And on your knees, no less. It seems to me that Solomon was pretty practiced up at this. And he stood and blessed all the assembly of Israel with a loud voice, saying, blessed be the Lord, who has given rest to his people Israel according to all that he promised. Not one word has failed of all his good promise, which he promised through Moses, his servant. May the Lord our God be with us, as he was with our fathers. May he not leave us or forsake us, that he may incline our hearts to himself, to walk in all his ways, and to keep his commandments and his statutes and his ordinances, which he commanded our fathers. And may these words of mine, with which I have made supplication before the Lord, be near to the Lord our God day and night, that he may maintain the cause of his servant and the cause of his people Israel, as each day requires, so that all the peoples of the earth may know that the Lord is God. There is no one else. Let your heart, therefore, be wholly devoted to the Lord our God, to walk in his statutes and to keep his commandments as at this day. It was a good day in the history of Israel. It was a good day in Solomon's life. It was a good day in the history of the nation, and the people were rejoicing. They were glad, and it's so easy to have a day like that where you say, I'm going to walk in his ways. I'm going to walk in his commandments. You know, maybe there's been a time of sin. Maybe you yourself have had a time of sin, a season of sin as they did. Remember, they were sacrificing in the high places. And something spiritual happens. You come to church and you experience this and you say, oh, Lord, I want to walk in your ways. I want to walk in your commandments. I want to obey your word. I want to abide in your word. And the key to that is to do that every day. The key to that is to every day continue on in it. It can't just be a Sunday morning or a Thursday night where you go, yes, yes, God is good. I believe God is good. I don't want to sin anymore. And then to walk back into it. That actually truly is the double-minded man. But to be consistent in it, to wake up every day, to give God the first fruits of your day and to say, Lord, I just want to serve you today. I want to walk in your ways today. It's the key. It's the trick to continuing on. Because it's really easy to show up in church and feel like this, to feel this great joy, but to continue on. The people of Israel did continue on for a season. It says, now the king and all Israel with him offered sacrifice before the Lord. And Solomon offered the sacrifice of peace offerings, which he offered to the Lord, 22,000 oxen, 120,000 sheep. So the king and all the sons of Israel dedicated the house of the Lord. On the same day, the king consecrated the middle of the court that was before the house of the Lord, because there he offered the burnt offering and the grain offering and the fat of the peace offerings. For the bronze altar that was before the Lord was too small to hold the burnt offering and the grain offering and the fat of the peace offering. So this seems to me to be the same thing that happened to my pastor Chuck Smith when they built their building. They built it ridiculously larger than they thought they would ever need. And by the time they had their first Sunday, they were at three services. And here they've done the same thing with the temple. They built it. It's huge. It's way bigger than it's, I think it was twice as big as the tabernacle was. And he had to go and consecrate the middle of the court as being a place for even more offerings, because the place they had made for offerings wasn't big enough. So what a blessing. So Solomon observed the feast at that time, and all Israel with him, a great assembly from the entrance of Hamath to the brook of Egypt before the Lord our God for 7 days and seven more days, 14 days. So the feast, remember that feast, the Feast of Tabernacles there, was a week long. They doubled it. They said, hey, let's double it up. You know, I'm thinking when the Lord's moving, it's good to double things. Stephen, let's pop in another 90-minute tape and just keep going. What do you think? Double it up. On the eighth day, he sent the people away and they blessed the king. Then they went to their tents, joyful and glad of heart for all the goodness that the Lord had shown to David, his servant, and to Israel, his people. The people went home glad. The people went home glad because of the goodness of God. And I hope that when you leave church after having met with God, that you go home glad. Because, yeah, sometimes things are tough. Sometimes the message is a lot about repentance and the refiner's fire burning things off. But that should make us glad. Yes, sorrowful over our sin, but it should make us glad, because remember that the difference between condemnation and conviction is where it draws us to. If the devil comes in and condemns you on a Sunday morning, if the devil comes in and the gist that you get out of the message is, man, you're a sinner. You're not even saved. You know, you're just a Pharisee and everything else. And you walk away and you're so bummed and the devil is condemning you. You know it's the devil condemning you because you're distant from the Lord. You don't leave joyful. You don't leave with a renewed commitment to walk with the Lord. But see, if it's the Lord convicting you, you can hear a message about repenting of sin and burning off that extra stuff that's in your life that shouldn't be there. And you say, yes, God. Yes, I'm convicted in my heart. Yes, I want to draw nearer to you. And so we should always leave the same way that they left. When somebody truly experiences that glory of the Lord in the place, is you go to your tents joyful and glad of heart for all the goodness that the Lord had shown to David, his servant, and to Israel, his people. You leave glad because of God's goodness. And as we're talking about, you know, an angel the size of Mount Rushmore and talking about how God is so big the heavens can't contain him and how holy he is and righteousness he is and how he will judge people for their wickedness, I hope that doesn't make you go, oh man, I can't even have a relationship with God. But I hope that instead it turns your heart around so that you say, God is that big and he loves me. God is that big and he left that place and became a man to become my servant and die for me. Oh, Lord, you're so good. Oh, I just am overflowing with joy that I could mean so much to you that you pay attention to me when even the heavens can't contain you. So I hope you leave this place with joy on any given Thursday, on any given Sunday. Whether the Lord brings an encouraging message or a rebuking message, that you would leave with joy for the goodness that God has. Let's just bow our hearts before the Lord tonight and thank God for his goodness.